Hello and welcome to the History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on today's show, my co-presenter John Dorney from TheIrishStory.com will be interviewing Fionnuala Walsh about Irish women and the First World War. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the History Show, go to nearfm.ie/podcast/tag/the-history-show.
Fionnuala Walsh, we're talking about women in Ireland and the First World War. People often refer to the First World War as the first total war, a war that had an influence on or an impact on all of society. Do you think the First World War had more impact on women across the board than previous wars?
I think so, yes. Women were quite heavily involved in the First World War on the home front and in terms of military nursing and so forth. And, you know, actually quite near the front in France and Turkey. I think it was, you know, it has been described as a watershed moment in terms of women's rights internationally. I think that is something that's a bit more complex, but it still is certainly a very significant period in women's history.
Mm-hmm. So before we just get onto Ireland, I mean, women served in nursing, they served in logistics.
Munitions work.
I mean, they did work in factories, which was, that was something new.
And this is something that became a very big issue at the time, particularly like in Britain, where about 1 million women served in munitions factories. And they became known as munitionettes. And I think what was important then was they were doing what was typically male work in factories, and they were, you know, constructing shells and ammunition, artillery. It was really part of the male sphere. There were propaganda posters with, you know, a picture of munitions women saying, "On her, our lives depend." And this idea that they were actually really helping the soldiers, that it wasn't just nursing, you know, it was actually a very active role in the war effort. That to some extent, the progress of the war depended on them.
Almost a macho role.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Why was this such a big break? I mean, can you talk about gender relations a little bit? At the time, just before the First World War in Britain, you had the suffragettes, so-called, which meant they're looking for the vote for women.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about gender roles and why the war had such an impact on them?
Yeah, well, like at the time, women were very much second-class citizens. They, you know, had far less rights than men. They, as I said, they couldn't vote, you know, in terms of the job opportunities, in terms of inheritance, in terms of property rights, you know, and all this. They were very much second-class citizens, and, you know, within marriages, such as the man was very much the dominant person. But there were a lot of women in the workforce in Britain and Ireland, and this is something that has to be stated because it's often overlooked, but they tend to be in very low-paid and very underappreciated jobs. A woman worked out of necessity, but it's very difficult for, you know, women to get into jobs and professional classes, and so women tend to be, you know, much less educated. They simply, you know, wasn't colleges were often were closed off to them, and second level education was aimed at preparing them for the domestic sphere rather than, you know, future jobs.
Mm-hmm. So then the war comes along, and the war, just the demands of the war, needs more body power. I was going to say manpower, but
Definitely. So, and this idea came that they needed to release as many men as possible for the front. And so they also needed to have a very a large number of people working in factories, whatever, to produce the materials needed for war. So women were simply needed. And so there was a deliberate policy to employ more women in these factories than men to try and encourage women into the sphere. So there is a sort of a shift in thinking regarding women. But what does need to be said is that this was something that existed for the duration of the war and was seen as an act of patriotism in wartime. Mm-hmm. But was not seen by anybody as sort of heralding long-term change. Mm-hmm. The idea was that they would come into the factories for the 4 years and then they would leave. Mm-hmm. And so after the war, there were, you know, immediate attempts to demobilize women as quickly as possible. And so when you had the issue of returning soldiers after the war, women who tried to stay on in such work were, you know, vilified as war profiteers, as, you know, people trying to take the jobs from the deserving soldiers. So it needs to be recognized that this was seen as a, you know, temporary aberration.
Let's move to Ireland in particular. Now, war broke out in August 1914, and obviously there was a massive recruitment drive, because Britain and Ireland didn't have conscription until 1960. Yeah. But what struck me about some of the posters was how women were used. I mean, there was one poster says, the woman says, must I go over there or will you go over? So it's kind of shaming their masculinity. Yeah. Another one says, will you protect your women? The Hun will come and take your women. Yeah. What do you make of that?
Yeah, there is an awful lot of use of women in the propaganda posters. It's interesting in the Irish context in that, you know, Ireland is often portrayed as a woman. You know, Kathleen Na Hoolahan and Ban Nair and this kind of idea. But they're kind of turning this on its head and using it, you know, in a different sort of way. And, you know, in a lot of these posters, you know, women are portrayed as, you know, vulnerable individuals who need to be protected, and the men folk need to defend them. And there certainly is, there's an element of shame that's very, it's very dominant. And you get pamphlets being produced, do you have no women worth defending? And there's also propaganda addressed to the women saying, have you no men folk to send out there? Calling on the women to encourage their husbands, brothers, sons to enlist. You know, the representation of women in these propaganda posters is quite interesting.
Do you think this worked in Ireland? Do you think women sent their menfolk out to the British Army?
I'm sure some did. I'm sure, you know, it had some impact. You know, there were over a million propaganda posters produced by British War Office in circulation in Ireland during the war. It's very difficult to know how many actually enlisted because of, you know, propaganda would seem to be one factor among many.
I'd imagine that for Unionist women, would mean one thing, and for Nationalist women it would mean another thing.
Yeah, definitely. You know, one's reaction to the war and to enlistment obviously depended on where one's political ideologies before the war. You know, there were Unionist women involved in active recruiting campaigns. You know, you didn't see this on the Nationalist side. Like, there are a lot of people sort of in between Unionism and Nationalism in Ireland at that time. And, you know, a lot of middle class people who enlisted, and whose
home rulers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And whose, you know, wives and sisters, whatever, were very involved in voluntary work for the war effort.
Mm-hmm.
It was often like a whole family endeavour. So women who were involved in voluntary work tended to come from families where somebody had enlisted.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see, you know, an influence gone both ways there.
Sure. Yeah. What does this involve, voluntary work?
It took many different forms. One of the most well known is nursing, Red Cross work. For example, over 6,000 women on the island of Ireland were involved with the British Red Cross and St. John's Ambulance Association during the war. So this was both serving within Ireland, in auxiliary home hospital, in auxiliary hospitals within Ireland and in military hospitals, and also in England in hospitals there, and also on in France on the front. And also there was also other forms of volunteer work involved helping prisoners of war. For example, the Irish Women's Association was established, which sent parcels off to Irish prisoners of war in Germany. And so people would, you know, create parcels themselves and send them off to this organisation. There are also many organisations established at a local level to help soldiers. They're called sending comforts to soldiers, cigarettes and parcels of food and mufflers and hats and gloves and socks and whatever. So these often exist at a local level where, you know, committees would be established in towns, and then people would gather material and send it off. Another significant area of voluntary work in Ireland was through the Irish War Hospital Supply Depot. This depot created dressings to use for wounded soldiers. There was a shortage of cotton wool during the war, and so there's this type of moss grown in Ireland called sphagnum moss, was shown to be very useful as a cotton wool replacement. And so there were 43 depots established, the headquarters in the Royal College of Science in Dublin. And over 6,000 women were registered with this organisation, collecting and drying and sending off this moss. And then it was sent off to hospitals all over Ireland, England and Europe.
You mentioned 6,000 women involved in that. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea how many women in total worked in the war effort?
Well, the difficulty with this is that there's going to be an awful lot of overlap. Okay, so, you know, we have 6,000 women doing that, and then we say, you know, we're 6,000 women with the British Red Cross, St. John's Ambulance Brigade. But that doesn't mean there are 12,000 women. You know, most likely these women were involved, a lot of these women were involved in two organisations. And at a local level, you know, some of the smaller organisations, it's more difficult to establish numbers and to work out exactly how many. We are looking at a reasonably significant number. Now, in terms of, you know, in terms of British Red Cross and St. John's Ambulance Association, those two organisations formed a joint committee during the war. Like, it's less than 1% of the population, female population, that were involved with that particular organisation. So we have this idea of women as nursing during the war, but, and, you know, it was a reasonably significant endeavour, but it's still a very, very small percentage.
1% of the Irish population at the time would be like 40,000 or so.
It is significant, but its significance shouldn't be overestimated.
We're probably talking now about a different social class, probably, to the volunteer women, but a lot of working class women were affected by the war in two ways, in factory work and there was a munitions factory open here, I think.
Yeah.
And in the famous separation money. Yeah. So can you, first of all, say something about the women who came to work in war factories?
There were 5 munitions factories established in Ireland during the war. 5 state-run national shell factories established in Ireland. There are 2 in Dublin and 1's in Waterford, Cork and Galway. Hmm. And these employed over 2,000 women.
2,000 in total?
Yeah.
Okay.
There were also company-run munitions factories which were producing munitions work and employing munitions workers, but they weren't state-run. Well, there's 1 in Wexford, Pearsis, and 1 in Belfast, Mackey's. And also in Dublin, there's the National Fuse Factory, which was also doing similar work and employing women. It has been estimated that between the National Shell Factory and the National Fuse Factory, over 900 women were employed in Dublin in munitions work. Mm-hmm. The state-run factory, Parkgate Street. And there was a policy at the time that only 5% of employees in these factories could be men or boys. So the vast majority of the workforce were women.
So this goes back to what we talked about before, where they wanted men for the front.
Exactly. And you see this also in terms of other jobs at the time, a reluctance to employ men of military age. Mm. For example, there's a porter's job which came up in salvage in the First World War in Kildare, and the Board of Guardians stated that they were reluctant to employ a man of military age. They wanted either an older man or else a woman for the job. And there was also the issue of munitions work. There was a lot of lobbying during the war to get more factories brought to Ireland because they were seen as a very lucrative form of employment. And so the Irish Parliamentary Party particularly were lobbying a significant amount to get these factories brought to Ireland. And it was seen as a political issue that the British government weren't locating them in Ireland as a sort of an effort to keep the South deindustrialised. Mm. Now, this doesn't really stand up because the North didn't get very many munitions factories either. Mm. There was no state-run munitions factories in Northern Ireland, or in Ulster, rather. But most likely the reason that there weren't more munitions factories in Ireland is simply there was no logistical reason to place them here, and there were security reasons why it wouldn't have been a good idea.
Mm, like sabotage would be...
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
We talked about at the start that the idea of women working in factories was kind of a shock for society at the time. How did that work in Ireland? Were people shocked at women entering factories like that?
Not as much as you might expect. There was, again, it was seen as, you know, something very much to do with the war. And it's seen as something that could be tolerated in wartime and applauded in wartime, but was not seen as, you know, heralding any lasting change. And so it could be accepted without there being any cause for concern. And so, you had, local groups lobbying for factories in their area for women to work in, but there wasn't any sort of, there wasn't too much concern that, it would result in any long-term change. During the war, there is increased concern about women's sexual morality. And there are women's patrols established in Dublin and Belfast, which is middle-class and upper-class women patrolling Dublin and Belfast streets at night, looking for women behaving badly. It's a very interesting example.
What does that mean, women behaving badly?
Women consorting with soldiers, women drinking, women behaving inappropriately.
At the time, Dublin had a very large red light district as well. So was this a massive departure, really, of the war years?
No, it wasn't really. But it became an issue of much greater concern during the war years. Like, the same thing happened in England. There was this whole idea of khaki fever. And this idea of... it was partly to do with soldiers. This idea that, women spreading venereal disease. And so women were now a threat. But in Ireland, there was also a sort of a nationalist element to it, in that idea of women consorting with British soldiers was unacceptable. It was linked also into the separation of women, this idea of women are drinking too much during the war. Mm-hmm. But again, it's an issue of sort of wartime paranoia. Mm-hmm. But these patrols, they're quite a significant issue, run by many different women's organisations. The suffrage campaign, for example, the Irish Women's Local Government Suffrage Organisation became involved. There are also women who became involved as in the hope that it would lead to police work. And the first women's police force was established in 1917 in Ireland. And so it wasn't a sort of a way of promoting middle-class women's interests. Mm. But there's middle-class women acting as surveillance of working-class women. So there's a very definite class issue there.
You mentioned the separation women. Mm-hmm. Now, if anyone who's familiar with the nationalist history of the period will have heard of the separation women, who were supposedly these slum women, degraded, got money from the British Army, from their husbands being at the front, and that they, in a blackguardly fashion, assaulted the good nationalists of Ireland. Yeah. So what can we say about the separation women?
Well, yes, separation women were soldiers' dependents, usually soldiers' wives, and they got a weekly allowance from the British War Office to compensate them for their husband's absence, the absence of breadwinner. And the theory, so their soldier husband had to actually make provision for this allowance. They had to agree to their family receiving this money. And the idea, it was partly to encourage recruitment. So your family will be safe when you're gone. The issue raises a lot of class issues, because for those in very low incomes, the allowance represented an increase in income. Well, for those who were even reasonably well off, even working class, it was a drop in income, and so they had to struggle, and there was, you know, issues with household economy and difficulties household management during the war due to the vastly increasing food prices in this period. There was concern that women who were on the allowances, that they were not spending these allowances appropriately. So there's a lot of concern about separation women, as they're called, drinking away these allowances. Mm. Now this issue came up in Britain as well. It wasn't exclusive to Ireland, but in Ireland it became a much bigger issue due to the interaction with these women and the nationalist movement.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, especially after the Easter Rising, which mm-hmm. again we'll talk about in a minute, people talk about the separation women abusing and physically assaulting the volunteers.
Yeah, there is. I've done a study through the Bureau of Military History, the witness accounts there, and there is a significant amount of evidence of these women, interacting with the nationalists during and after the Rising. There are over 40 statements, individual statements, which reference women either during the Rising, sabotaging nationalists where possible, reporting on the rebels, attacking them outside Jacob's factory, and then particularly after, when they've been arrested and they're marching to Richmond barracks, there is apparently a mob of these women shouting at them and jeering them, and in some accounts throwing stones and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The accounts tend to reference them as women from the tenements,
mm-hmm.
From the local slums.
So what should we make of this? Is this purely an economic thing? I mean, they view it as a threat to their separation money, or is there something more going on?
It's a difficult issue. Certainly, the nationalist accounts of it suggest an entirely economic motive. This idea that the GPO meant they couldn't receive their allowances during the week. The rebel takeover of the GPO, and so they were reacting against this. Now, there is actually a couple of reports of the rebels providing provisions for these women during the week because they couldn't receive their allowance. And apparently they were giving them more than they would normally get. So there were some accounts of these women supporting the rebels on this account. Padraig Yates has suggested that the Easter Rising coincided with the first anniversary of an attack in France where a significant number of rolled up and fusiliers lost their lives. And he suggests a connection between the two events. So these women, their husbands were fighting in France. The rebels were fighting men in British Army uniform who wore the same uniform as their husbands. And you could see how they would view these men as traitors, as betraying their husbands over in France. So there is an emotive reason there as well. And there's also, a lot of people believe at the time that the rebels were in receipt of German gold. There was a lot of propaganda against Germany at the time, atrocity propaganda. And so they saw these men as going over to the enemy side.
Mm-hmm. It's easy to scoff at some of this stuff, like, you know, women patrols and, you know, the separation women. But, I mean, the other thing about the aftermath of the Rising is many women actually looted of the shops. So I think that Dublin slums may have been a very wild place at the time, which we can't appreciate.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, if you look at the 1911 census, you can see the circumstances in which these women lived. You know, huge families living in single room dwellings. And, you know, the real poverty that these women lived in cannot be overestimated. And, you know, some of the accounts of the rebels attempting to stop the looting, you know, it does show a somewhat There is also that separation women are not just an issue at the Rising. What is interesting is that they also appear in nationalist accounts from both 1915 and 1917-1918. For example, in April, I think it is, 1915, there is a parade, through Limerick, volunteer parade. And there are over 20 individual witness accounts which reference the issue of separation women on this parade, mainly as they pass to an area known as Mungret Street, which was traditionally home to British Army soldiers and their families. And as they pass through this area, there are accounts of women forming a mob, jeering them, shouting chants about up the khaki and to hell with the Sinn Féiners and so forth, and throwing stones and physically attacking them. And the volunteers tend to report this event, and they tend to, when they write about it, they use it as an example of how they were a professional army and they showed great restraint in not attacking back and not using their guns.
Mm.
So they tend to write about the event as, yes, there was hostility, but we behaved very well. But it seemed to have been a very significant issue at that time. The issue also becomes more prevalent in 1917, 1918 with the by-elections and the general election, 1918. And again, at this stage, an issue comes into play of the separation movement as an organised mob, as not spontaneous reaction, and also suggestions of a rent-a-crowd idea and links between them and the IPP. This idea that the women were deliberately being plied with drink by parliamentary parties supporting publicans and then let loose on the streets with their aprons full of stones and sent out to attack the volunteers. And they represented a significant enough threat that extra consignments of volunteers were drafted into some of the what were considered the most dangerous areas. For example, in Waterford, volunteers from neighbouring counties were brought in to protect the Sinn Féiners from these women. So they weren't treated lightly. They were, you know, seen as quite a serious threat. And it is interesting to explore the language used to discuss these women and the sort of language used in propaganda at the time, and, you know, propaganda posters of both sides and this idea of the defenceless woman needing male protection. And then you have these women who are, some of the men say, I was more scared of the women than of the men.
Mm.
I was afraid to go down the street because of the women. So they are seen as an actual physical threat.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a class and a gender thing going on.
There is, definitely, yeah.
But of course, women played quite a substantial part in the actual Rising itself,
yeah,
in Cumann na mBan and in the Citizen Army. So yeah, can you say a little bit about nationalist women or separatist women?
Yeah, Cumann na mBan was established in April 1914, and it was established really to provide support facilities for the male revolutionaries. It was kind of an auxiliary group. And when the war broke out, as with the National Volunteer Movement, there was also split in Cumann na mBan as to their decision on how to react to the war. And so, as with the National Volunteers, the majority supported Redmond. And then Cumann na mBan somewhat disintegrated and a new rump was formed, Cumann na mBan too. And this group remained committed to the nationalist cause and to the separatist movement. And there are examples of Cumann na mBan attending meetings to do with Red Cross work and, you know, organised by Lady Aberdeen in the early weeks of the war. But they later explained their presence as simply to get tips on how to respond to, you know, how to use these skills in the nationalist struggle.
Mm.
During the Rising, there were significant numbers of Cumann na mBan women involved. The number varies between 140 to 200 in the accounts. Out of a total of 1,500 rebels, it's, you know, a reasonably significant figure. Women tended to play gender-specific roles in the Rising. Cumann na mBan, their role was to mainly nursing and catering. Now, they also did, though, deliver dispatches. And this was a fairly important job due to the telegraph and telephone wires being down. And so they carried messages all around the city. And this was, you know, quite a dangerous job as well as a very important one. That was seen by the women as the most elite job. That's what the one they wanted. They also said some of these women carried ammunition across the city. They tended to wear Red Cross uniforms while doing this in the hope that the British would then let them passed by, and they were actually often escorted around the city by the British while carrying messages and ammunition. This is quite a contentious issue in some of the historiography, in that there were also actual Red Cross nurses active in Dublin at the time helping civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And so some have suggested that by wearing the Red Cross uniform, the Cumann na mBan women were actually putting the actual Red Cross nurses at risk when it was realised that some of the Red Cross women weren't authentic. They were also in charge of, you know, securing food supplies for the garrisons other than GPO, which were mostly very short of food. And this wasn't just, you know, this wasn't just a simple, safe job. For example, Mary Hyland threatened a milkman with a bayonet to hand over a can of milk. And Lily Kempson has been reported as holding up a bread cart with a revolver. And they also looted the local shops when supplies ran out, which is something that doesn't get a lot of attention. So there is, you know...
So it wasn't just the slum women?
Exactly, yeah. You know, their role wasn't as restricted as some accounts might suggest.
Mm-hmm.
The Irish citizen women, the Irish citizen army women have been taught to have been treated more equally. But... They were given guns, but Connolly told them to only use them in self-defence. And he told them to restrict themselves to first aid and catering. Like Constance Markovic, her actual job during the Rising was to act as a chauffeur to deliver food supplies. She abandoned her post and got involved in another activity, but that was her actual job. And she, you know, claimed she was appointed to a deputy position, but there is no other evidence to support this. Over 79 women were arrested by the British military, but the vast majority were released very quickly. Only 5 women were interned, and Markovic was the only one tried by court-martial.
Mm-hmm.
This compares with 3,430 men arrested, of whom 1,836 were interned and 170 tried by court-martial. So again, like, women are playing very much a minority role in the Rising, but still an important one. And the families of, you know, the nationalist leaders played an important role in disseminating information and assisting each other in the immediate aftermath.
In 1914, when the war was relatively popular in Ireland, judging by the amount of people who joined up, women were used in propaganda to, you know, to go, as we said, to goad men almost into joining up. But by 1917, 18, the war was pretty unpopular in Ireland, judging by the opposition to conscription. So what part did the women play in the anti-conscription campaign?
Yes, women played a significant part in the anti-conscription movement. In 9th June 1918, Cumann na mBan organised Ireland Women's Day, Lá na mBan. The idea being to collect pledges that they would not support conscription. Over 40,000 people signed this pledge. There are also marches taking place all around the country, led by women. This movement drew many different women's organisations together, but it was primarily led by Cumann na mBan. But other organisations include the Irish Women's Workers' Union, the Protestant Women's Anti-Conscription Society, the Irish Drapers' Assistance Association, you know, a wide range of organisations. The women at the time, you know, they agreed to not take men's jobs. It's very wide scale, very significant protest movement at the time, and women's role was quite significant in it. Cumann na mBan greatly benefited from the anti-conscription movement. Their membership increased hugely that year, from 100 branches in December 1917 to over 600 by September 1918. But this increase was quite temporary, suggesting that it was the anti-conscription movement which drew people in. Partly as it's a very emotive issue, and so it drew in people who would not necessarily have supported all of the aims of the nationalist movement, but who felt that Ireland shouldn't be conscripted.
One thing that occurred to me just as you were talking was, since women were used to promote recruitment, were women also used in propaganda against conscription, as in mothers don't let your sons be killed, this kind of thing?
I haven't seen too much of that, but there very possibly was. There was a, you know, the women were urged to take up this movement for their menfolk. There was sort of a, you know, you do not want to let your men be killed over in France, so, you know, join this or whatever. One thing that's interesting about it is that it was conscription in Britain which had the most significant effect on women's role in society. Because of the conscription, more women had to take over men's jobs. And not just in munitions factories, but also, you know, as bus conductors, as clerks, as shop assistants, very visible roles for women. But in Ireland, it has somewhat the opposite effect in that, women were active in the public sphere fighting against conscription, but they were deliberately refusing to take any male jobs and sort of confining themselves to a supportive role.
Before leaving the war and talking about the legacy, Just one more question occurs to me. What about women trade unionists? If we talked about women contributing more to the workforce, did women get involved in trade unionism, which was just becoming very widespread in Ireland at the time?
Yeah, the trade union movement benefited from the war. There was a great increase in trade union membership during the war. And the National Federation for Women Workers, which is a British-based organisation, set up in Ireland for the first time during the war, particularly unionising women in munitions factories and other factories producing war materials. The membership levels, were much more significant than it had ever been before in terms of unionising women. But at the end of the war, women were demobilised very quickly from this work. Mm. And the unions fought to try and get benefits for women afterwards and to ensure that women who took over skilled work during the war would not have to return to domestic service, but this wasn't possible. And most of the women who were employed in such factories had no choice but to return to lowly paid work in domestic service and other similar areas.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that brings us on nicely to the legacy of the war. And we talked about that the war was exceptional in its demands, and for that reason people accepted exceptional roles for women during the war. Women also played significant roles in the political mobilizations that happened in Ireland for and against the war. So what was the legacy, do you think, of World War One on women's lives in Ireland?
Well, one of the most important outcomes of the war really was the Representation of People Act of 1918, which granted women suffrage, women over a certain age suffrage. And this had an important impact. The confidence within women's organisations and their... By September 1918, Cumann na mBan started saying, well, we shall address women's role in the nation. So you can see an increased self-confidence within these organisations, and they're no longer happy to just play a subservient role to the men. And the same thing happens with the Unionist Women, Jilsa Women's Unionist Council. You can see, by the end of the war, a sense of that women's issues must now be addressed. Well, before they were very happy to, and they refused to discuss suffrage, political movement had to come first. During the war, there was increased concern with both maternal and infant health. This is again an international thing. This idea that you needed a healthy population to defend the country. There were reports done on infant mortality, and it was discovered that a baby born in Dublin in 1915 had about just as much chance of surviving the year as its father fighting in France. There was also this issue of concern. So the soldiers, were defending Ireland, and there's a sense of society owed their children and that they had to look after them. So during the war and in the immediate aftermath, there was increased measures to try and improve the circumstances in which people lived and to improve the infant mortality rate and the maternal mortality rate. There was an act passed in 1917 to provide for better midwifery care and prevent people acting as midwives without any training. And there were attempts made during the war to ensure greater registration of births, to ensure better survival chances for infants. And so this continued to some extent in the aftermath of the war. Although again, once the war had ended, the immediate incentive for these activities lessened to some extent, and concern somewhat petered out over the next few years. The difficult thing with Ireland is, of course, distinguishing the aftermath of the war from the very significant political turmoil over the next few years. And so, Ireland goes from one war to another, and so it's difficult to assess long-term impacts against that background. Women's organisations that became vitalised and reinvigorated during the war, the United Irish Women and the Women's National Health Association, and some of the religious organisations like the Mothers Union, Girls Friendly Society, suffered during the War of Independence and the Civil War, as it was very difficult to organise during these times, and also their aim of staying out of politics just became impossible to fulfil. And then with the Protestant organisations, there is a departure of some of their members for England. And so it's difficult to, at the end of the war, we might say, oh, these organisations have done quite well. They've managed to bring in new members. There's an increased interest in the work that they do, and women's role has become more prominent in the public sphere. But then this quickly changes, and it becomes a lot more complex and a lot more quite difficult to analyse the effects.
A story for another day, maybe. Okay. Yes, indeed. Fionnuala Walsh, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
So that was John Dorney speaking to Fionnuala Walsh of Trinity College Dublin about Irish women and the First World War. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of The History Show, go to nearfm.ie/podcast/tag/the-history-show. My name is Cathal Brennan, and thank you for listening to The History Show on Near FM.